Now, I'd actually like to begin by asking, how many of us here have heard previously about the Rambam? You could raise your hand. Okay, that's a lot of people, which is great. If you have it, that's okay. That's why you're here. So for all those who have, I'm going to play a bit of a game, which I'm hoping for your participation, which is always, a gamble, but let's try it. If I were to ask you in one word to describe the type of person the Rambam was, or his contribution, or his philosophy, in one word, how would you describe the Rambam from what you know?
Prolific.
Prolific, great word. Prolific.
Eclectic.
Monumental.
Brilliant.
Brilliant. Okay, these are all, that's undebatable. You can, undebatable, he is brilliant. Yes.
Eclectic.
Rational.
Eclectic. That's
He
an
was
interesting
very
one.
Profound, and also
Profound.
What has to remember, he was also a physician, and he actually wrote the treatise of asthma. Just
You know, Rose, I did ask for one word, but those were all great. So
rational.
Thank you
How
so
about
much.
rational?
Paul says rationalist. Okay,
Neat.
that's a good one.
Thank
That's a
you.
good one. Multidisciplinary. Okay, so everyone's saying a lot of great suggestions. I would tell you that it's very hard to describe the Rambam in one word
I was going to say
because
scholarly.
I appreciate that everyone is already on target here. I think contrary to some popular belief of some, obviously, the Rambam is a very complex
Controversial.
character. Very complex. Meaning some would say he's a rationalist. The Rambam is the intellectual, very rational. That being said, the Rambam definitely was a believer in a form of mysticism in his time. And he certainly believed in miracles, although in his own way. Some would say the Rambam was progressive. He was somebody who wanted to change things. And he made some tremendous changes, really changed Jewish thought, Jewish law forever. He was also a traditionalist. He was also someone who was very rooted in tradition and very rooted in the halachic system. And very adamantly opposed to those who prescribed certain beliefs which he thought were outside the boundaries of tradition. And some would say, if you look at some of the Rambam's writings, he seems to be a fierce sort of, stiff personality. And he does argue vehemently and courageously with other rabbis in his time. He holds no shots. But he's also, as we'll see, compassionate to people who needed that compassion. He's also, in some ways, very understanding. So it's very hard to pin down the Rambam. I'd like to sort of explore that with you today. And what I want to do today is to learn a bit about the Rambam's life. What's fascinating about the Rambam is that probably more than any other figure in his time, we know a lot about his life. We can actually track the many stages of the Rambam's life and his development, his travels throughout the world, because we have letters that he wrote, and specifically with the new development of what we found in the Geniza in Cairo, the Cairo Geniza, which is sort of what a record of documents in Cairo that has been found, and the Rambam spent a lot of time in Cairo. We really do know a lot about him. And what I like to show is that while the Rambam made some incredible changes, really he changed the way Jewish life worked forever, that comment came from the way he saw himself, and specifically the way that he saw the time period that he lived in. That he felt that he lived in a time period that was in the need of a specific type of leadership. And he felt that he was the person to provide that leadership. So with that, I'm going to share my PowerPoint, and hopefully we will begin. Okay. There right now. I hope everyone can see. Okay, beautiful. So just to begin, I have here the flyer for my series. I also have on the right a book by Moshe Halbertal, Dr. Moshe Halbertal, called Maimonides, Life and Thought. It's really a great book. You can get it online. We're going to be quoting a lot from that today, especially today, because he does a great job of sort of documenting the Rambam's life. Okay. Let us begin. The Rambam was a monumental figure. That's what I want to begin with. The Rambam was known as a person who was totally singular and unique. There was no one like him in his generation, so much so that his name, the Rambam, Maimonides' name was Moshe ben Maimon, Moshe or Moses, and the Rambam was known as the Moses of his generation, meaning there's a statement from Moses, meaning Moshe, our teacher, to Moses, Moses, the son of Maimon, Maimonides, there was no one like Moses. Hadn't been anyone like him since Moses. That is quite a claim. But this was the way the Rambam was known. And it's important because not only did others see himself that way, but he saw himself that way in a sense also. Take a look here at this quote from Rabbi Aaron ben Meshulam. Now, for those who were in my class a few weeks ago on Provence, maybe you'll recognize this name. He was a scholar in 13th century Provence. As we'll see, Maimonides, although he didn't live in France, just southern France himself, many of the scholars of Provence were great supporters and benefited from the Rambam's thought. But here's where Rabbi Aaron Meshulam writes about the Rambam. Indeed, his God sent him, meaning Maimonides, to restore his people, for he saw that the sages' capacity had fallen short, and a lot of the children of Israel was becoming more and more dismal. And so he raised his arm and extended his mighty rod over the sea of the Talmud, so that the children of Israel might enter the sea on dry land. And from the sea of foolishness, he drew his people, instilling his Torah. So at what that line, and so he raised his arm, the Rambam raised his arm and extended his mighty rod over the sea of the Talmud. What is that a comparison to?
Moses stretching out his arm over the Dead Sea.
Exactly.
The Red Sea.
Just like Moshe raised his rod and split the Dead Sea, the Maimonides split the sea of the Talmud. And this is how they saw him. Moving on. Now, here I have a quote, and it's, again, Halbertal's translation, from Samuel ibn Tibbon, who was a...
Rabbi?
Yes?
One point. You say split the Talmud. Did he split the Talmud?
I don't think it means split in the sense that he divided it. We'll talk about it briefly.
That's it.
With the Talmud, I think here he means made it walkable, made it so that
made it available to
exactly made it accessible to the general public.
Lovely, yes. Thank you.
Absolutely, no problem. That's the point. That before the Rambam, who could venture this great wilderness of the Talmud? It's just inaccessible. The Rambam made it available to the people, and we'll briefly discuss that. Although that's not going to be our focus. Here we have someone, Samuel ibn Tibbon, whose family was responsible for translating many works in general, and specifically the works of the Rambam. And he writes as follows. Since the sages of the Talmud, almost no one has been inspired to compose a book or write something about these sciences. Here he refers to what we call Ma'aseh Brishit and Ma'aseh Merkava, which are two disciplines described in the Talmud as secretive, as esoteric. And he's describing how no one could write about these topics. For the Rambam, this meant metaphysics and certain sciences. For others, it meant something different. But the point is that no one could write about these things. It was enough for them to write about laws, about what is prohibited and what is permitted, until God, seeing the poverty of his people's thought and their great ignorance regarding all matters of wisdom, right? This is him describing the Jewish people, ignorant in all matters of wisdom, sent them a redeemer, a wise and understanding man, a wise artisan with an understanding of mysteries. Since the time of Rav Ashi and his cohort, Rav Ashi, one of the leaders of the Talmudic sages, the Amora, we're talking centuries earlier. Since the time of Rav Ashi and his cohort, we have not known one like him among our people with respect to all matters of wisdom. He's a true sage, divine philosopher, our master and our teacher, Moses, the servant of God, the son of the great sage of Maimon, may his memory be for a blessing. Again, and this is describing not the Rambam's work on Jewish law, Mishneh Torah, which we'll discuss briefly in a minute, or a few minutes, but his work the guy for the Perplexed, which we'll spend more time discussing. And they said, no one could have written this except for the Rambam. And God sent us the Rambam because as a savior in this time of despair. That's how people view the Rambam. And the Rambam, not in, a, in an arrogant way, but in a self-aware way, the Rambam also saw himself in this way. He saw himself as someone who had the capability to help his people at a difficult time. And you see this in a passage in the Guide for the Perplexed, which refers to these topics we just discussed, meaning these topics referred to as Ma'aseh Merkava and Ma'aseh Bereishit, the wisdom of the divine chariot and the wisdom of creation, which the sages warn about discussing in public, which the sages warn against talking and teaching people who won't fully understand them. The Rambam wrote about them anyway, even though in the Talmud it discourages public dissemination of these topics. The Rambam taught them anyway in his Guide for the Perplexed, and here's why. He writes as follows. If I had omitted setting down something of that which has appeared to me as clear, meaning if I didn't write this down as I clearly understand it, so that the knowledge would perish when I perish, as is inevitable, I should consider that conduct as extremely cowardly with regard to you and everyone who is perplexed. Meaning, why does the Rambam say, despite the fact that the sages said not to write this down, I'm going to write it anyway? Why does the Rambam do that? Because he says, if I don't do it, no one else can. If I die, that's it. You're going to lose this wisdom forever. So what can I do? It's cowardly to not share this with you because you're going to lose it forever. That is the way the Rambam saw himself. And so the point I want to make then is that, I'll take your question in a second. The Rambam, as we're about to see, made tremendous changes. And let me list the two most profound. The first is his work on the Halakha called the Mishneh Torah, which we'll read about in just a minute, where the Rambam went through the entire Talmud, which is not a book, as I've described in the previous series. If you look at the Talmud, it's disorganized, it's tangential, has no beginning, it has no end. You don't always know what the conclusion is. You have topics dispersed throughout a huge body of literature, and the Rambam took all of it, organized it, and came up with a concise, clear bottom line on every single issue and said, this is Jewish law. That to even think about how someone could even do that is incredible. The amount of work it must have taken to even write a treatise like that on one topic, let alone what the Rambam felt was everything. Everything, including topics that were discussed at the time and topics that weren't studied, laws that had to do with the temple, laws that had to do with purity, which were not even relevant anymore. The Rambam took all of them from all over rabbinic literature and organized them. That's his first huge change the Rambam implemented. And the second, the Guide for the Perplexed, in which the Rambam, in a systematic way, engages with the questions that philosophers, not just Jewish philosophers, but secular philosophy was dealing with at his time. And he said, I am going to integrate both secular wisdom and Jewish wisdom and see how they can work together. And that no one had done that. We'll see, others had studied secular wisdom, certainly, but no one had tried in the same systematic way the Rambam did to integrate them and to formally sort of issue a statement of beliefs in the way the Rambam did. But the reason he made these changes is because he felt that they were necessary, his generation needed leadership, and he was the one to do it. Okay, yes, Susan.
You know, everything we're saying, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but he sounds quite arrogant as well.
It's a fair point.
But he has a quality of, I'm the only one who can. And maybe he was the, but it's coming across with, like when he said, if I recall, you know, Nobody needs to read anything more because I've written it all down in my Mishnah Torah. I mean, isn't there a certain amount of godly himself thinking as almost a Moses or God figure himself?
I agree with your point. I'll make two responses. Make 2 points in response. One is I'm giving you a snapshot of a few statements the Rambam made which come off in this way to make a point. As we'll see, he has other statements where he says, I'm a nobody, I'm humble, I'm just a refugee from Spain, and look what I have to do. On the other hand, I think you're right in that you're right. He thought he was very unique. But what does one do in that situation? Meaning, as the rabbi say, Bimkom she'ena neshtim hishadel lihiyo ish. Meaning, if in a place where there's no one else to do the job, you got to do it. And if the Rambam thought, look, and people turned to him, right? This wasn't just, I'm awesome, listen to me. It's people looked to the Rambam. He was prominent, as we'll see. And they looked to him for guidance in a lot of ways that I hope to get to, at least some of today. I know a lot of people are raising their hands a bit already. I hope to get to today. I think that you could either say, look, who am I? I'm a nobody. Like, you know, who am I to say that I'm going to make this change? Let me just let things continue. But the Rambam felt that's cowardly. It's irresponsible. People need me, so I have to do what I have to do.
And I'm not saying he wasn't.
I agree with your point, and it does come across in a certain way as arrogant. People saw him as such. People saw him as arrogant. People told him, like, what are you doing? This is not the way it's done. At least tell us where you're coming from. But the Rambam said, look, I have to do what I think is right for the Jewish people.
I just want you to understand. I know he was unique, and I know he was brilliant. It's just sometimes we portray him. Till you've mentioned the humble part, he is portrayed as this kind. And I just was wondering if you, because you were talking about him as a person, how he viewed himself.
Right. So I'm showing that now. Let hold that thought, and we'll see a bit more how he saw himself as we go on. I'll take two quick questions. I'll take the three quick questions, but I do want to move on. So if you could be brief, that'd be great. Yes, I think Rose is first. Not sure, but. Go for it. Bye. Okay. Jeanette.
Okay, it's not a question. I have to stand up for Rambam. I think it's so important for us to remember that humility and arrogance in Jewish thought is completely different from humility and arrogance in secular thought. Humility in Jewish thought, who is the most humble man? Moshe Rabbeinu. Did he not know how great he was? Did he refuse to go up and talk to Hashem 101? You know, one-on-one. Humility in Judaism means I accept my gifts. I know my gifts. Mm-hmm. I also know they come from Hashem. They have nothing to do with me. And if he gave me this gift, what does he want me to do with it? And I have to take this incredible gift that Hashem gave me, which I have no credit for, but I've got to do Ratzon Hashem. That's not arrogance. That's almost the opposite of arrogance in Jewish thought.
I agree with the point. I think there's two ways. It's a tough balance. And those are a way you say something. I agree with everyone saying. Mark, do you mind if we go on for a bit? Because we have so much to cover. And is that okay?
It's just a very short thing. Yeah. He was about the arrogance. It was extremely controversial because Mishnah Torah, he elected not to provide sources, which was hugely controversial.
We'll get to this. Let's move on. Okay, so as we already mentioned, you see this in Mishnah Torah. Look what he writes here. Okay, and this is again the Rambam's work on Jewish law, a monumental, comprehensive work on all Jewish practice, not just law, by the way. It's philosophy, it's health advice, it's everything. And the Rambam writes as follows: after the court of Rav Ashi, you compiled the Gemara, which is finally completed in the days of his son. Extraordinarily great dispersion of Israel throughout the world took place. The people emigrated to remote parts and distant isles. The prevalence of wars and the march of armies made travel insecure. The study of the Torah declined. The Jewish people did not flock to the colleges in their thousands and tens of thousands as heretofore. But in each city and country, individuals who felt the divine call gathered together and occupied themselves with the Torah. Study all the works of the sages and from these learn the methods of legal interpretation. Meaning, I'll leave the quote here as you can read it, but let me just summarize. Rambam's saying, look, people have a difficult time now learning. Education is not as common. It's only the select few. And even the works that we have, as you'll see here from the Gaonim, people don't fully understand them anymore. It's not because the Gaonim didn't do a good job. The Gaonim, meaning the rabbis from a century or two earlier, from originally Israel and also Babylon and Baghdad, the Rambam had a complex relationship with them. But he says we just don't, most of the general public can't access these works anymore, and therefore have to do something about it. And therefore, he writes, and again, could this potentially come off as arrogant? Yes, it can come off as arrogant, but this is what the Rambam thought was necessary. He writes, generally speaking, the author of this works that the reader won't need any other composition in the world for any law among the laws of Israel. Rather, this composition will gather the entirety of the oral tradition with the decrees, customs, and edicts which were issued from the days of Moshe until the composition of the Talmud, and as the Gaonim explained to us in their compositions after the Talmud. And that's why I'm calling it the companion of Torah, Mishneh Torah, for a person should read the written Torah first and afterward read this. Says the Rambam, all you need is a Bible and this, and you're good. Is that a bit arrogant? I think so, honestly. Others did too. But the Rambam's saying, look, not everyone can look up a Talmud. Not everyone can look up a tractate. Not everyone can look up a Midrash. So I'm telling you, this is what you got. I'm giving it to you in an organized, clear, succinct way. Now, where does this all come from? How did the Rambam become this figure? So let's go a bit through his life. Let me just briefly stop the share and share with you a map of where we're going to go here. So the Rambam is born in Spain, in Cordoba. And if you want to see, here we go. Let me share my screen with you, actually. Just the map quickly. I see we're already running a bit late, but I think it's important. Here you go. Ooh, let me zoom in a little bit. So we're starting off. One second. Sorry about that. Here we go. If you look here, it says where it says Cordoba. This is where the Rambam was born. It's also known as Andalusia. And this area of Spain, as I'll discuss in a second, was a stronghold of Jewish thought. It was a very prosperous, fruitful community that the Rambam was born in. He was born in a place of great scholarship. As we'll see, ultimately, he has to move because of persecution. I'll just show you what happens, and then we'll read about it in just a second. He starts in Cordoba. The Almohads, which was a radical Islamic sect, take over Cordoba, and Rambam and his family have to leave Spain. They actually first go to Morocco, to what was known as the Maghrib, first in Fez. That didn't work out well at all. It actually, scholars are perplexed as to why his family moved there. There was even more persecution there. Ultimately, as we'll see, they can't stay there either. He has a brief stint in the Holy Land in Israel, what was at the time. He stays there briefly until he ultimately ends up in Egypt in a place called Fustat, which is close to Cairo. So you see, he probably ended up in Israel and ultimately went back to Egypt. This is the travels of the Rambam. Let's discuss a bit about his upbringing, how the Rambam grew up. What was life like in Cordoba, where the Rambam grew up, right? Rabbi Moses ben Maimon is born in 1138 in Cordoba, Andalusia. We actually had, apparently, I saw the exact date he was born. He was born in Erev Pesach, from what I understand, so that's coming up. And we actually even know the hour of when he was born. So there's a lot about the Rambam. Now, it's worth noting, this is very important. The Rambam, where he grew up, was a bastion of Jewish thought in every discipline. In poetry, you have famous Jewish poets like Shmuel HaNagid, Shlomo Ibn Gabirol, the author of the Kuzari, Judah Halevi, Ibn Ezra, Ibn Ezra, the well-known biblical commentator who wrote poetry himself. In philosophy, and in this part of the Sephardic community, and in this area of Spain, Jews were very well versed in secular wisdom. The Rambam got training not just, as we'll see, in Torah, but in the sciences and in philosophy and in medicine. And philosophy, Jewish philosophy, also flowered. You have the duties of the heart, the book called Chovat HaLevavot, written by Rabbeinu Bachya Eben Pekuda, the Kuzari, and in Jewish law as well, Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, one of the prominent rabbis of that time, the Rif, ended up moving from Morocco to Lucena, which is in Andalusia, and he was the head of the yeshiva, and Rabbi Yosef Halevi Ibn Migash, known as the Ri Migash, who was the Rambam's father's Rebbe, also is there. So it's a place booming with knowledgeable people, scholarship, philosophy, poetry. It's this spiritual wonderland. That's how the Rambam saw where he grew up. His father as well. His father, Maimon, Rambam, or Maimonides, is known as Maimonides because he's the son of Maimon. Maimon was a judge. Although the Rambam primarily viewed himself as a student of Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi and the Rebbe Ibn Migash, not that he knew them, but his father taught them their teaching and their opinions. One second, please. Okay. Now, the Rambam's family also was a aristocratic family, not in the sense of, you know, at this point, aristocracy in terms of connection with the government, but a family of scholars. He traces roots 7 generations back to a name, judge named Ovadia. His Arabic name is Ibn Abduya or something like that, because of the fact that his earliest ancestor was named Ovadia. And he learns, he receives halachic, philosophical, and scientific training in Andalusia, so much so that at the age of 16, he writes his first work on logic. The age of 16, already when he's still a youngster, he wrote his first famous work on the halakha in Jewish law, known as the Pirush HaRambam Ala Mishnah, the commentary on all of Mishnah. Mishnah being one of the first works of the oral tradition. The Rambam wrote that at age 23, shortly after he left Cordoba, after he left Andalusia. And so already at a very young age, he was prominent. He was well known. And the Rambam, as we'll see over the course of the series, was very familiar with philosophy. And he studied, he was an admirer of Aristotle specifically. And he studied not Aristotle directly. Aristotle lived centuries earlier, but there were many Muslim philosophers whose work was to interpret philosophy, and the Rambam studied them. The Al-Farabi, Ibn Bahaya, Ibn Rushd, also known as Averroes. These are well-known philosophers. The Rambam was very well-versed in philosophy. Now, they didn't get to stay. And as I said, the Almohads, which is a radical Islamic movement, conquered North Africa and Andalusia. Now, what happened next? So it's, again, this is fascinating and scholars don't really know why. Some Jews from Andalusia, faced with essentially the option of either convert, die, or leave. That was their option. Some left to Provence. Provence, as I discussed in an earlier series, was also a flourishing place of Jewish thought. However, the Rambam didn't go there. And if you picture it, you know, we're in Spain, to the north, you're going to have southern France, and some moved there. The Rambam didn't go there. He went to Morocco with his family. We don't know why. It didn't solve the problem. It was even worse there, but that's where they went. But the point is, the Rambam had a tremendous amount of admiration for where he was born. He saw that as almost a spiritual wonderland, and for the scholars that lived in Andalusia. And therefore, even when he disagreed with them, he did so with the utmost respect. And even when he disagrees in the guide with the philosophy of the others in his area, he had no regard for other schools of thought, such as Kalam. Even though he disagrees with it, he doesn't name them. He disagrees with Kalam. He disagrees with their philosophy. He won't say, I disagree with Ibn Ezra, who was, you know, who was steeped in astrology. The Rambam rejected astrology, but he didn't say, I disagree with Ibn Ezra, because Ibn Ezra was from Andalusia. And this is what Halbertal notes here, that therefore, think about this. The Rambam saw Andalusia as his spiritual wonderland where he grew up. After its destruction, it was traumatic. It totally shaked him. It shook him. His whole life was altered. And he sees himself almost as this refugee from Spain. And here we'll see some of that humility. Look what he says about himself. I'm one of the humblest scholars of Spain. This is in a letter. Whose prestige is low in exile. I'm always dedicated to my duties, but I have not attained the learning of my forebearers. For evil days and hard times have overtaken us. We have not lived in tranquility. We have labored without finding rest. Right? How can the law become lucid to a fugitive from city to city, from country to country? Rambam was a lot more prominent than many other of the scholars in his native homeland. And yet he says, who am I? I'm a nobody compared to them. That's how he viewed himself. He sees himself as someone who has been exiled from this homeland. Now, what happened next? The Rambam next goes to Morocco. As I said, it's worse in Morocco. I don't know. We don't know really why they went to Morocco, but that's where they went. And it's even worse there. The Jews of Morocco lived in a very, very difficult situation. Many of them were straight up told, either convert or die or leave. And this was a very difficult time for them. And in this context, we get to one of the important letters of the Rambam known as Igeret Tim Hashmad, or Epistle on Martyrdom. And the context is as follows. There was a rabbi, as we'll see, in the Rambam's time, who basically wrote that the Jews who converted to Islam, or at least attested their faith in the prophet Muhammad publicly and in the God of Allah, lost their place in the Jewish community. Meaning these Jews who were keeping Judaism and halakha in secrecy, but publicly proclaimed their faith in Islam. This other rabbi wrote, they're no longer Jewish. It's as if they're not Jewish. Their mitzvot don't count. They no longer have a place in Jewish society. And the community of Morocco turned to the Rambam for guidance. They say, what do you think about this, our great leader, our great teacher? And again, what do you think? What should have we done? What can we do now? Give us perspective. And that's what this is about. Now, and I think, again, showing how complex the Rambam was. As we'll see, the Rambam was forceful when he needed to be, but when he needed to be, he was also very compassionate and understanding. And the Rambam begins this letter, and you can look at it. It's a long letter. We won't go through the whole thing. First of all, by totally chastising this other rabbi who criticized the community. And he says, look, you think you're the only one who, I see in the chat with South France, Ashkenazi, or Sparty, a bit of both, but mostly, I believe, Spartic. It's a combination, though. So thank you for that question. But getting back to our presentation here, the Rambam writes, what, you're going to criticize this community? You think you're better than Moshe Rabbeinu and Elijah the prophet? They had a slight criticism of the community. They said something wrong. They were angry. And then God punished them for that, the sages write. And you're going to tell these people who are in such a difficult situation that they're no longer part of the community? And he gives examples of rabbis in the Talmud, without going into it in depth, who were put in a situation where they say something which sounds like they're agreeing to heresy, where in reality they weren't. That's not what they meant. But they also gave the impression when under duress that they were agreeing to heresy to save themselves. And he also provides examples. You're going to tell me these people had no reward for their commandments? Nebuchadnezzar, the king, the emperor of Babylon, who destroyed the temple and killed, at his orders, thousands of innocent people. The rabbis write how he got some reward for giving honor to Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar, for a little thing that he did nicely, was rewarded. So first he spends the first part of his discussion saying, number one, chas b'shalom, heaven forfend, to say that these people don't get rewarded for their mitzvah. That's just crazy. This rabbi, just don't listen to him. It's absurd that he said such a thing. So it's compassion. He's not telling them anything crazy. He's not telling them anything novel in halacha. He's just trying to be compassionate toward them. And then he has a very monumental ruling, which I'll briefly summarize as follows. He says generally that although, according to Jewish law, if one is faced with the choice between idolatry or death, Jewish law indeed does say that one is obligated to give up their life rather than commit idolatry. That's the choice one has to make. Nevertheless, the Rambam says, if you fail, if you don't make that choice, you don't get punished. Meaning it's the right thing to do, but one doesn't get punished for not living up to the test. That's one. Two, he says, specifically in this case, the Rambam rules, Islam isn't considered idolatry. They also believe in God. And although their belief is that the Torah is no longer binding and that it's a mistake and it's forged and the real Torah is Muhammad's revelation, that doesn't constitute idolatry. And therefore, one isn't obligated to give up their life rather than attest to a faith in Islam. And it's specifically in the case where it's just a verbal declaration that's necessary, right? But the point is, the Rambam says, so number one, chastising this community is wrong. Be compassionate. Number two, generally, even if this was idolatry, you wouldn't be obligated to give up your life. I mean, you would be, excuse me, but if you don't, then we don't punish someone for not doing so. Number three, Islam is an idolatry. And especially when you're not serving any idolatry or you're not participating actively in another religion, you're simply declaring, I believe. And that's certainly not punishable. And here's what he says. He says, you know, who are you to chastise these people? You know, if people like Moshe and Eliyahu and Yeshaya are punished for chastising them, you think this rabbi is not going to get punished? Really? And he says, this persecution is remarkable. There's never been such a thing. And here's the interesting thing. He says, anyone who suffered martyrdom in order not to acknowledge the apostleship of that man, meaning Muhammad, the only thing that can be said of him is that he has done what is good and proper. Yeah, that's admirable. His position is very high, for he has given his life to the sanctity of God. But if anyone comes to ask me whether to surrender his life or acknowledge, I tell him to confess and not choose death. Meaning it wasn't the wrong thing. Mm. Now, I'll get to the conclusion. This is not so simple. If you look in the Rambam himself, the Rambam says generally, if you're obligated, if you have the choice, if the halacha tells you that you should not be a martyr, if halacha tells you that you're not supposed to give up your life and you do, in the Yad HaZakah, in his work Mishnah Torah, the Rambam writes, it's a grave sin to unnecessarily give up your life in the event that Jewish law tells you you don't have to. But the Rambam doesn't write that here. The Rambam says those who did choose martyrdom are praised. Now, how do you reckon with that is an interesting question, but I think part of it is the Rambam recognized that as a leader and a rabbi, you have to have a certain type of flexibility in dealing with the needs of a community. So while maybe in his greatest convictions, the Rambam would say it's a grave sin to voluntarily martyr oneself, he thought that the message, and maybe he acknowledged there's a variance of opinion on this, which there is. For instance, the Bali Atosafot, the scholars in Northern who lived through the Crusades, were very open to the people in their community who did engage in volunteer martyrdom. Nevertheless, the Rambam thought to this community, the message they need to hear is that if you didn't give up your life, that's okay. But if you did, you're also heroic. Now, at the conclusion of the letter, the Rambam says, all this is well and good, but you gotta leave. You can't stay there. You can't stay in such a community. And if this is gonna happen, you have to leave, no matter what. And then he and his family leave, Maghrib as well. So he followed this sort of advice. And then finally, after much wandering, the Rambam and his family arrive in Egypt, which is where the Rambam essentially settled the rest. What do we know about the Rambam's family? Not all too much. We know about he married in his 30s, which was late. But then there's more to say about that. The Rambam was of a certain belief. He discusses in his work, Mishnah Torah, that if someone is very engaged in their studies, they can delay marriage. The Rambam, we don't know much about his mother or his wife. The culture in the Rambam's time, it was Islamic culture, and generally it was a patriarchal society. Mm-hmm. Women's names often go unmentioned. And I'll note, and I'm not going to go into this, so don't ask too much, please. Maybe afterward, I'm happy to discuss it, but the Rambam is known as a progressive, right? In a certain sense, he was open to secular knowledge. He was no progressive in the realm of, you know, male and female interaction. He was not a progressive in that way at all, really. He pretty much adopted the stance of the society around him, the Islamic stance. And so it's complex. Now, I'll note that the Rambam writes about Miriam, the prophetess, that given her opportunity for education and her spiritual stature, she reached the highest level of prophecy, such that she died through the kiss of God, which is reserved for only the greatest prophets. But that being said, the Rambam, we don't know much about the Rambam's wife or his mother. We know of his brother David, who we'll get to in a bit. And we know he had three sisters. One of them was named Miriam. And finally, Miriam's name is my daughter also, so I'm a big fan of the name Miriam. Maybe Moshe and Miriam is interesting, right? But his son, maybe one of the things he was most proud of was his son, Rabbi Avram ben Arambam, who was a scholar in his own right. And the Rambam writes in delight of the gifts and the intellectual prowess of his son Avraham. But his family really begins in Egypt. When the Rambam arrived in Egypt, he already reached incredible prominence. He was already seen as the primary, at a pretty young age, halakhic authority and a leader of the Jewish community. And you see this here. Here we have a letter where the Rambam is writing about an effort to ransom prisoners. And the Rambam didn't just write about this. He was involved in communal needs, and he fundraised himself. The Rambam fundraised because he wasn't just a rabbi. He was a leader. He was the leader. And he writes, "So do as we had done, all the judges, elders, and sages. All of us go forth by night and by day, rousing people in synagogues and markets, doorways, until we achieve something for this great cause. Since we have contributed what we're able to for them in accord with your honor, we ask that you too contribute." Meaning he's a good fundraiser. He says, look, we gave what we can. You give also to help ransom the prisoners. But you see, the Rambam was very involved in the communal needs. Now, in terms of his leadership role in the community, again, the Rambam was able to make the changes that he wanted to. Originally, in 1171, which is just 5 years later, he's appointed Reish al-Yahud. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. I did my best. Which is the official head of the Jewish community. That means the Muslim government appointed him to be in charge of the Jewish community in Egypt. And he made a lot of changes. He had the authority to do so. I'll just share one with you now, which is as follows. Some people sometimes say or lament that nowadays, you know, people don't appreciate synagogue or they don't appreciate prayer. And look how much the generations have fallen. Hmm. The Rambam had the same problems that we have nowadays. Take a look at what he says here. The Rambam got rid of the silent Amidah, meaning when you pray in synagogue, the highlight of the service is the Amidah, the silent service that, you know, known as the 18 benediction, 19 benedictions, the Shemona Esrei, and usually we pray in silence, and then the cantor repeats the Shemona Esrei for the public. And the Rambam abolished the silent Shemona Esrei in his community. And he said on Shabbat and Yom Tov, we're all to pray once together. And the cantor will pray out loud and everyone else will play silently. Why? Look what he writes. "And what compels me to do this is that all the people at the time of the prayer of the cantor do not watch what he says, but speak with each other and go out. And he blesses a blessing for almost no reason. It's a bracha levatala," meaning the Rambam saying, look what happens when the chazan repeats the Shemona Esrei. People are talking, they're schmoozing, they're doing their other things, they're not involved, right? You know, nothing has changed in, 900 years. It was the same problem for the Rambam. You know what he said? We got to stop it. We have to stop it. And we're all going to pray together. You can. We can all fulfill our obligation with the, either by saying it silently. And this way, those who don't know how to pray silently will take the chazans, the cantors' repetition seriously and fulfill their obligation by listening. And so this is what the Rambam had to do. And it's a drastic move. It's a drastic move. Imagine the rabbi of your synagogue said, okay, we're not going to do the silent Amidah anymore. You got to have shoulders to do that. The Rambam had the shoulders. Okay, now in terms of his position in Egypt, the Rambam was prominent, but that doesn't mean it was always easy. The Rambam faced great opposition. I can't go into this in depth now, but just know that there was another Reis Al Yehud when he got there. There was a back and forth between, his name was Sar Shalom Alevi and the Rambam. The people didn't like this person. One of the reasons for that is that this Sar Shalom Alevi was the head of the Jewish community. When the Rambam got to Egypt, had a policy whereby he charged a tax for halachic rulings. And there was a judge who didn't want to agree to this notion. And he refused to do it. And there was sort of politics, and there was a fight. And the people said, we're going to support this judge. And they go to the Rambam and say, will you support our effort to essentially forbid paying this tax to the judge against the head of the community, the Sar Shalom Alevi? And the Rambam does. The Rambam does support that ruling. The Rambam generally was against accepting any sort of compensation for rabbinic roles, as we'll get to. And he didn't take money for acting as the rabbi. So the Rambam, it was a back and forth. And the Rambam, you know, ultimately lost that position again to Sar Shalom Alevi only after 2 years in office. But that being said, he ultimately got it back in 1194. And even though he was no longer Reis Al Yehud, he was a big voice in the community. He was the leader, even if unofficially, the leader of all Muslim communities in Islam, in Islamic kingdoms. He was world-renowned. And you see this in Igeret Teman, which is another one of his important letters. Again, I know I'm rushing, but I want to cover as much as we can so at least we can begin the Guide for the Perplexed next time. So I'm happy to stay for a few minutes afterward for questions. Thank you. So the Rambam, as the leader of the community, and I want to show this, was not just, again, a halachic decision maker, but also generally a leader for all the needs of the community. And you see this in his Igeret Teman, the epistle to Yemen. And again, this shows the difficult, challenging time the Rambam lived in. Islam presented a specific challenge to the Jewish community. Because Islam, on the one hand, were claiming to be the new faith, like other faiths do, and that they were picking up the revelation of Judaism and they were the perfection of it, but they also were monotheistic. And think about that. Meaning, other religions, which also claim to be the truth, presented a certain, you know, heroism, and we reject that because we believe in one God. They believe in multiple gods. We don't believe in that. We're going to be heroic. Islam is more confusing because they believed in one God. And they even gave some legitimacy to Moses and to the revelation, but they just said, you guys got it wrong. We are the bearers of that tradition. It's our tradition now. We are the realization of the Messianic age. And this was hard for the Jews to combat because you don't have that same heroism in sort of combating idolatry, number one. Number two, they had a point. The Jews were miserable. The Jews were downtrodden. The Jews were in control by these Islamic kingdoms. There were false messiahs. There was all sorts of desire for something better, and it didn't pan out all the time. So the community is desperate. And they reach out to the Rambam for some perspective on how they should view themselves in their time and the struggle against Islam. Is it true? Have we lost our mission as God's chosen people? If not, why is this happening? What do we make of this religion? And the Rambam, without going into all of it, paints a picture whereby, briefly, again, there's too much to cover to go into it in depth. The Rambam writes to them and paints a historical picture of the Jewish mission. And he writes how this already predicted in the prophets, there are different types of challenges to the Jewish people. And originally it was physical persecution. It was people physically torturing us. And ultimately it was sort of an ideological persecution of idolatry where people were saying, reject monotheism and become pagan and accept our gods. And the prophets, including Daniel and others, predict a time where this last challenge of Judaism takes place, where instead of reject your belief in monotheism, it's you guys got it all wrong. We're God's chosen people. We're the new Israel. We're the monotheists. And the Rambam's message is, don't think of this as just this new challenge in and of itself. This is just a progression of the Jewish fate. This is part of what we have to deal with. This is God predict this for us. We have to endure these challenges. And he gives a context to it. Again, what's noteworthy about this letter is that there aren't that many legal innovations. He's not saying anything so innovative, but he's painting a historical picture so that people can endure their reality. And he writes as follows, I'll read briefly here. Now, all my fellow countrymen in the diaspora, it behooves you to harden one another, the elders to guide the youth, then the leaders to direct the masses. Gain the assent of your community to the truth that is immutable and unchangeable, and the following postulates of the true faith that shall never fail. God is one in a unique sense. There is one God, and Moshe is his chosen prophet, and there will never be another revelation that uproots this original prophecy. It will never be abrogated, no matter what anyone says. This original prophecy that we got from the greatest prophet of all time is eternal. It will not be exchanged. And you have to teach that to your children. Tell them about Har Sinai. Tell them about Revelation. Strengthen them. Give them hope. And that's our key to survival. And this, for those who recognize, this is part of the Rambam's 13 principles of faith, where it's a reaction to the fact that there's a challenge to this faith. And therefore, the Rambam says, In order for this to continue, in order to maintain our tradition, we need to strengthen ourselves. We need to know that there are going to be challenges to our faith, but we have to be confident that God chose us and he continues to choose us, and that revelation is eternal. There isn't going to be some sort of exchange. God doesn't say, you know what? Got it wrong the first time. Let's have a do-over. That's not how it goes. And again, this is the Rambam acting as the leader, acting as a compassionate leader, reaching the needs of his community. Now, this all happened during the most fruitful time in Rambam's life, which was the Rambam, and this is when the first 10 years in Egypt, when the Rambam wrote his Mishneh Torah, which we discussed, his book on Jewish law, and he really enjoyed a lot of time. He was prominent. He was a leader. It doesn't mean that he didn't have any opposition, but this was the best time in the Rambam's life. Then tragedy befalls the Rambam, specifically in the death of his brother, David. His brother David was very close with Rabbi Moshe, the Rambam. He was in charge of the family business. He was a successful merchant. And tragically, he died on a voyage in the Indian Ocean. And not only did he die, but the entire family fortune sunk with him. And this left the Rambam without the ability to totally dedicate his time toward writing and teaching and learning, because he now had to fend for the family and support himself. And the Rambam wasn't happy to take money for his rabbinic position. And so this is where, famously, the Rambam uses his medical training and becomes one of the most important doctors and politicians in Egypt. But look here how he writes about his Rambam, his brother. And it's interesting because if you look in the Mishneh Torah, the Rambam writes about how it's not appropriate, it's inappropriate to grieve egregiously, to grieve too much, to spend too much time mourning. And yet when his brother passed away, look what he writes. For almost a year after receiving the sad news, I lay on my couch, stricken with fever, despair, and on the brink of destruction. Another place, close to 8 years have now elapsed, 8 years now have now elapsed, and I still mourn for him, for there can be no consolation. What can possibly comfort me? He grew up on my knees, he was my brother, my pupil. He went abroad to trade that I might remain at home and continue my studies. He was well-versed in Talmud and Bible, an accomplished grammarian. My greatest joy was to see him. Now every joy has been dimmed. So the death of his brother had a tremendous impact on the Rambam in his life. And from then on, he was very, very busy. He became, again, the Rambam received his medical training in a previous life, beginning in Spain and Morocco. He was a trained physician, and he used that to become a very prominent physician in the government, but he lost all of his time. He had no time to write, no time to teach, and it was a much more chaotic time for the Rambam. Just give you a brief example. I know I have to close soon, and we'll finish the story of the Rambam's life next time. But he writes as follows. I tell you that I have become known as a physician among the mighty, such as the chief judge, the emirs in the house of Al-Fadil, who was, I believe, a brother-in-law of the Saladin. So these are important government officials. I am beyond, and are the other princes of the land, those who lack nothing. But as for the masses, I am beyond their reach. They have no way to approach me. I can't help the community. This caused me to spend the entire day in Cairo, tending to the sick. And when I get back to Fustat, which is where he lived, all I can do for the rest of the day and into the night is examine my medical texts that I need to consult. As a result, I do not have a moment to study Torah except on the Sabbath. And as far as the sciences, I do not have a moment to study any of them. And he writes about his grueling schedule. I have no time. I barely have time to eat. I eat once a day. People ask me questions all day. I have no time to rest. And he writes to people who wanted an answer or want a translation of the Moreh. He says, I'm sorry, but like, I don't have time to teach you. I don't have time to write to you. I'm just so busy. And this is what happened when the Rambam's brother died. Look what he writes here. I dismount from my animal. I wash my hands coming back from the palace. Go forth to my patients. I entreat them to bear with me while I partake of some slight refreshments. And the only meal I take in the 24 hours. Then I attend to my patients. Patients go in and out until nightfall. And sometimes even I solemnly assure you until 2 hours or more into the night, I converse with and prescribe for them while lying down from sheer fatigue. Right? Picture the Rambam after a long day lying on his bed and treating his patients. And when night falls, I am so exhausted I can scarcely speak. So the Rambam, again, experienced this incredible trauma. And this is what happened to him in Egypt. So I know we have to sort of finish here. I'll stay for some questions and comments. But I think what we've showed is that the Rambam lived a very tumultuous life. He was a very prominent figure. He was recognized as such. People turned to him for leadership, but he was complex. Fierce on the one hand, compassion on the other hand. And he was very much someone who felt he had a unique gift for dealing with the people who needed him and the unique challenges of his time. And as we'll continue next week, that I think really gives you a bit of an insight into who the Rambam was and what he did. And so next week, we'll continue with the story of the Rambam's life. Just a few more passages of how the Rambam dealt with people who disagreed with him or political pressure. And then we'll continue, I hope, to begin to discuss what the guide for the perplexed was and to begin to discuss some of the main issues that it dealt with. So thank you very much for listening. It's really wonderful to learn with all of you. I'll stay for a few moments to take any questions and comments.